My name is Gail Miller. I'm interviewing Pat Martin on behalf of the Northern Kentucky Historical Society. Pat, would you please tell us something about yourself?
We can start at the beginning. When and where were you born?
I was born in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, which is about 30 miles east of Lexington. I was born on the 30th day of May in 1898. My mother was Mame Fletcher and my father Clare Truman DeGarmo. Mother died in August, soon after my fourth birthday. My sister, who was 17 months older than I, and we were sent to a boarding school, Catholic Cardome at Georgetown, Kentucky. I believe it's still in existence. My grandmother Fletcher objected because she was a devout Methodist and she didn't want her two children, her two grandchildren, to grow up in a Catholic school. So at the end of the year, my grandfather DeGarmo said he knew of no other boarding school that would take preschool-age children. My father, soon after mother died, had been transferred to the Texas area being a paper salesman. My grandfather Fletcher had died the same month that my mother died, and my grandmother had gone to live with my aunt in Frankfort, Kentucky. There being no place for us two little girls, so the latter part of August in 1903, we were sent to the Methodist Orphans Home in Louisville, Kentucky. 6 weeks later, on October the 5th, I was adopted by Mr. and Mrs. Wesley Harlow, living at Baghdad, Kentucky, on a farm about 3 miles out of the little village. When a child is put in the Methodist home at that time, the parents had to relinquish all rights to the child. And the parents could only contact the child through the orphan's home. So at Christmas, a Christmas box was sent to the home, and in the box, my real grandmother wrote a letter to my new mother. When I opened the box at Christmas time, I was told it was from Santa Claus. But when I found in the box my old rag doll, she was almost as large as I was, and I had named her Minerva Sue. I jumped on her and hugged her and stomped her and said, "Oh, Minerva Sue, where have you been for so long?" So my new mother knew that I realized that the box had come from my grandmother. And then she read the letter and cried. She said she couldn't keep a grandmother, a child, from such a grandmother as that. And since I had said that they lived in Frankfort, I think my grandmother also put her address in. She told Daddy to hitch up the horse and buggy. See, in 1903, we didn't have cars. And so the next day, we drove up to Frankfort, 14 miles, and hunted up my grandmother and my aunt. After that, I grew up as a part of both families and am a part of both families to this present day. Only last summer, I visited two living cousins that were living in Frankfort at that time, when I went to Miami, Florida. You might be interested in what happened to me at the orphan's home. My adopted mother was very lonely on the farm, and she wanted a little girl. And Daddy was her second husband, and she had a boy that was 13 years old. She went to Louisville to the Baptist Orphans Home because they were Baptist, and the Baptist minister had told her about how to go about going to Louisville and adopting a child. So she went to the Baptist home, and she looked the children over, and she didn't see anybody that she liked. The pastor had said, "If you don't find a child at the Baptist home, I know of two little girls at the Methodist home, and they're nice children. Their cousin is my wife's music teacher, and so you might go and see them." So she went over to the Methodist home and asked to see the DeGarmo children. And the matron at the home said, well, you can't take them out because the home has a rule that every child has to stay here for a year before they can be adopted, because the more desirable children would always be adopted and the less desirable ones would be always left there. So Mother said, well, I'd like to see them anyway. And so I recall when I came into the room and I saw this woman sitting there, and I thought she had such beautiful big blue eyes. And she looked at me and she said, would you like to be my little girl? And I said, sure. My sister started crying and said, I don't want you taken away. And so I said, don't you worry, honey, I'll find somebody to give you a home. And the matron said, I told you that these children were not up for adoption. And Mother said, but I like this child and I want her. And the matron said, well, you have to wait till the year's up. She's only been here 6 weeks. And Mother said, are you the total boss? And she said, no, the superintendent. I'm only the matron here. The superintendent's downtown. So Mother said, please give me his address and I'll go see him. So Mother went in his office and took a chair, and she looked up at him and she said, I've come to sit. And he was rather startled. I've often heard her tell this. And he said, just what is it you mean? And she said, you have a little girl at the orphanage that I have to have, and I have to have her now. And he said, who is she? And she said, one of the DeGarmo children. He looked at the record. And he said, but you can't have a DeGarmo child until the year's up. And Mother said, but you'll have to break the rules. And I don't know how she did it, but anyway, she argued him, and he broke the rules. And he said, don't you think you should take the child on trial? And Mother said, no, we'll just sign all the papers right now. It'll be all right with my husband. And so she took me home with her. And when Gladys cried, Mother said that as soon as school was out, Gladys could come up to the farm and spend the summer with me. So that made Gladys feel better. And so she did come up to the farm that summer and spent the summer with me. But that's another story.
What primary and secondary schools did you attend? And what were those years like for you, Pat?
I'm kind of like Edith Bunker. If you ask me a question, you have to put up with a lot of background. I went to the country school, which was just 5 months schooling in those days. I can well remember the one-room schoolhouse and the pot-bellied stove and the big high bench that we were called upon to come when the classes were called. The second year that I went to school, I had read up to the fifth grade books because I was lonely on the farm and had nothing to do, so I spent all my spare time reading. I can remember when they called the fifth grade class and I would go up, and some of the larger girls would pick me up and set me on the bench because it was a pretty high bench built for older children, and my feet didn't touch the floor. I stayed in that school until I was 13 years old, and I was supposed to be ready then for the eighth grade. And it was a two-room school in the little village 3 miles away. So I was sent to that school, and I traveled by my own horse and buggy. I had an uncle that had a barn close to the school in town, so I'd have to drive there and put the horse in the barn, and then after school I'd have to hitch it up again. I wonder now, sometime at my height, how I ever managed to hitch the horse up. But Jim was a nice old horse, and I think when I stood him in front of the shafts and told him to back up, he just automatically did. And so I got the shafts in the harness, and everything worked out all right. I did all right in the eighth grade. But when time came for me to move on into high school, Mother said she didn't think I was had enough background to go to high school, and she wanted me to repeat the eighth grade. She was as obstinate about that as she was about my adoption, and she won out against the principal, and I had to repeat the eighth grade, even though I was one of the best students in the class. But then, when in repeating the eighth grade, the professor said that I could take up Latin and math, so I got some extra credits anyway. That school only had 2 years of high school, but by the time the 2 years was up, I had enough credits to be a senior at the county, at the city school in Shelbyville. And so I graduated from horse and buggy to ride a Jeep for 50 cents a trip to the school. Then I stayed from Monday until Friday afternoon and came home again on the Jeep. I graduated from Shelbyville High School then in 1916 when I was 18 years old. I had always said that I would be a school teacher. So it was all settled that by the time I had graduated that I would go to normal school and take a 6 weeks training so that I could be a school teacher. So in the fall of 1916, after the 6 weeks training in Richmond Normal School, I began teaching school in the one-room schoolhouse that I had attended. I had 25 pupils ranging from the first grade to the eighth grade.
Pat, did I understand you to say that you graduated from high school in June and you started teaching in September? How did that come about?
Yes, that's right. You see, in Kentucky at that time, they had schools for teachers, teacher training called normal schools. And the only requirement to get started as a teacher was to go to the school for 6 weeks and take training about the curriculum that was to be taught. Kentucky at that time had worked out a very excellent curriculum that could be used in the country schools where a teacher was teaching from the first to the eighth grade. And so that was where I went to school. And then when the 5 month school was out, I went back for the spring and the summer term to continue with my teacher training. Then I taught the second year at the country school, and Mother and Daddy said they hated for me to be gone away from home all summer, so they said that the next year I should not teach, but I should go the full year up at the normal school and graduate, which was a 2-year teaching certificate that they gave after you were there for 2 years. And so that's what I did, and I graduated in 1919 from the school, which is now Eastern Kentucky University.
Did you continue teaching at the country school?
That's another interesting story. One day I was feeling kind of ornery, and I hadn't done my history lesson too well, and I heard that there were some principals coming into Richmond to interview people to hire teachers for the next year. So my roommate and I said, let's cut classes and go meet those principals. So we did, and the man that interviewed me was from Maeslick, Kentucky, which was the first and the largest consolidated school in Kentucky. That was the first place that they had transported children in buses from all over the county to a consolidated school. I didn't have any idea where I wanted to go to teach the next year, but we just went and got interviewed. I had been getting $40 a month for teaching in Kentucky, and so he said, when Mr. Everett asked me how much money I would want, I said, kind of choked and said, well, I think I'd have to ask for $80. I was pretty nervous to double it, but anyway, I said it though I really thought. And so he said, well, the PTA subsidizes the teachers, but we've only been paying 65. But I'll go back and see if I can get the PTA to guarantee you up to $80. So I really didn't think much about it because I thought I'd ask him for an awful lot. And one morning before we had gone to school, they called me over the phone and said that I was wanted on the line. The principal from Maeslick, Kentucky was calling. And I said to my roommate, I said, oh my lands, if he offers me that job, what in the world do I do? And she said, here's a nickel, flip it, heads you go and tails you don't. So I flipped the nickel and it was heads. So I went down to the office to answer the phone. We didn't have telephones in that you could talk except right into the building. So I had to go to the office to use the phone. And Mr. Everett said, Miss Harlow, I talked to the PTA and they're willing to subsidize your salary to the tune of $80. He said, will you take the job? And so I said, okay. And that was how I got my first job of teaching in the consolidated school at Maeslick, Kentucky.
And how long did you continue in with that consolidated school system?
I only stayed there 1 year because at the end of that year I was offered a job in the city schools at Richmond. And that's where the normal school was. And I wanted to take some extra work, and I thought if I went back to the town where the normal school was that I could continue with taking some extra courses. And so I went back to Richmond, Kentucky, and taught the second grade, which I was trained to teach. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said I was a trained second grade teacher. I should have told you that I was trained in the first grade. I think what got me mixed up was because when I taught in the Norwood City Schools, I did a great deal of teaching in the second grade. So I think I better clear that up.
Okay. How much more time did you spend at the Richmond School?
At the end of that, just before the end of that school year, there was a fire and burned our school building down, and just about that time my boyfriend had argued me into getting married. So after the school burned down, I left the Richmond and got married.
And who did you marry, Pat?
I married Harry Martin. I was going with one of the young men from Maysville, and we went to town to shop, which was about 12 miles from Maeslick. And Harry was coming up to visit his cousin, whom I was dating. And so I met him while he was there visiting. And we started corresponding with each other. And so then A year and a half later, we got married. We were married. And I came to Cincinnati to live. In September of 1921, after I had married in April, that seemed like I couldn't stand it when the children were all going back to school. And so I had a friend over in Covington that had planned to teach the third grade in the Covington school, and something had happened that she couldn't take the job, and so she said, why didn't I take the job? So I accepted the third grade position in one of the Covington grade schools and taught over there for several months. When I took the job in Covington, I didn't know I was pregnant. But after I learned I was pregnant, and then when the time came that the world could tell I was pregnant, I immediately resigned, because in those days, pregnant women didn't teach school. It would be embarrassing to the children. I started raising my family then, and when my little girl was nearly 2 years old, we were living in Norwood, and I discussed with my husband about being a substitute teacher in the Norwood schools. And so I substituted in the Norwood schools for 2 years until I had another baby.
And what was the name of this, the first and the second baby, the names?
My first baby was this little girl named Betty, and my second child was a boy named Harry. Both of these children are married and living in Cincinnati. I didn't go back to teaching anymore, because during the meantime I became involved in volunteer work, such as president of a PTA, and I was became president of the board of the YWCA in Norwood, and then later became a chairman of the Girl Reserve Department of the downtown Cincinnati YWCA, and was on the board in the city.
Were there other organizations that you moved on to when you finished with those, or did you? Was most of your time concentrated on volunteer work?
Yes.
For over a number of years then?
Up to the present time.
I see.
I worked with the YWCA, I became interested in peace work. I recall that one of the secretaries said to me one day that she would like for me to read a book, The Power of Nonviolence by Richard Gregg. I read and studied the book. I got to the public library and determined then that I really was a pacifist, and that I thought that all wars were wrong, and that the causes that brought on the wars were the things that one should work with and not go out and fight the wars. The first real peacetime organization that I joined was the American Friends Service Committee. There was going to be a weekend conference someplace in Indiana. I can't recall now where it was.
Do you remember about what year that was?
I think that was after my husband died in 1940, because I had continued to work with the YWCA until after he died.
I see.
And later on, I heard about the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, And so I paid dues into that organization for a number of years, even when I didn't have time to attend any of the meetings, because I was spending most of my spare time with attending the American Friends Service Committee's work. And also, after my husband died, I had taken over his business.
Could we hear a little bit about what his business was and what you had to take over?
My husband had been known as the medical director for the Pollock Steel Company all during the war. But after the war was over, and they had sold one of their large Chicago plants, they said to him that he was too big for the job, but they wanted him to continue to carry on their work, but they wouldn't ask him to report any hours, just to supervise their work, and that he could go out and get some other clients, which he had done. And so when he died, he had a business known as the Martin Service Company, and he had a clientele of factories in which he handled the safety work and the workman's compensation department. The activities of the company consisted of four departments. The first was the Department of Safety. We tried to prevent accidents and gave the companies advice about safety equipment. If there was an accident, it was our job to see that the men had the best of medical attention in order to get them well in the quickest time possible. We also had the claims department, in which we saw that the men received the compensation due them without having to wait too long for it. Then there was the actuarial department, in which, by keeping the records straight and by handling claims properly and getting men back on the job, we could keep the insurance company, the company's insurance rate at the lowest possible level.
When you say we, Pat, you mean that your husband had that job, and weren't you asked to take over that job? Would you tell us how that occurred?
Well, after my husband died, a friend of mine from the Baptist Church, who was also the president of one of the companies, said to me, "Why don't you take over Harry's business?" And I said, I just thought I'd go back to teaching school. I had never thought about it. And he said, "I think you could, and I'd like to see you try." So I called up the presidents of five of the largest companies that he worked for, and told them that I had made a contact with Mr. Rutledge, who had formerly been with Mr. Martin, and he had agreed to come back and work for me, or with me, to teach me the business if they would think that I could run the business. And each one of the presidents of those companies said they were willing that I should try, and I said, "Well, if I'm not a success, you can cancel the contracts." But it turned out that I continued for the next 25 years until I was 71 years old. There were many interesting aspects of the company. We really operated in four different departments. There was a safety department, in which we organized the foreman of all the companies into safety committees and had regular meetings with them. We discussed the type of accident they had and how we could prevent it. We had also a machine, slide picture machine, that we took to the different factories and showed a series of lectures that would help them prevent accidents. Then in the medical department, if there was an accident, it was our job to see that the men had the best of medical care in order to get them back on the job as soon as possible. In the claims department, we handled their claims to see that they got their compensation that was due them and got it without being delayed. Then there was the actuarial department, in which we audited the rates to see that there were no errors and the company had the lowest rate possible for their insurance. You see, in the state of Ohio, they have what is known as a monopolistic state fund, and you can't take insurance out with any accident company. You have to take it out with a state fund or else be a self-insurer. A few years after I took over the business, Mr. Rutledge said to me that all my competitors were entering into the unemployment field, and why didn't I get into it? He said he was too old and didn't care to work that hard. And younger, but he didn't want to be bothered, but he wished that I would go ahead and branch out into that field. I made an analysis of how I could help. The National Lead Company was the first person I decided to try it on, and I drew up what I thought would be the right kind of a contract and decided on what I would charge them. And told them that I would give them the same kind of good service in the unemployment field as I had given them in workman's compensation field. And this was in January of 1 year, and I sent the letter and the contract to the Chicago office, and about 4 weeks passed and I didn't hear from them. And then on the 5th day of February, I got the contract back, dated the 1st day of February, and found that I had been working for them 5 days when I didn't know it. Then another interesting thing happened. I did not have any employers that carried self-insurance. One day, the president of the insurance department of the National Lead Company called me from New York and said that he had a very important message to give me, that the National Lead Company had just bought the Dohler Jarvis Company that had 3,600 employees in Toledo, and that that company was a self-insurer, so the National Lead Company was going to go self-insurers all over the state of Ohio. At the time, I had 4 factories under my supervision. He said this wouldn't make any difference with me. I would stay on with the same arrangements. The only thing that I would have to operate the account as a self-insurer. I was kind of taken back, so I said that's fine, but I wondered how I would get along operating as a self-insurer, which I had never done. But I got the law books and began to study the requirements of a self-insurer. And so I didn't express to them that I'd never had a self-insurer, so it worked out all right. I managed. In working in the unemployment department, the law said that if an employer will make a trial audit and pay an advance premium, he can get a reduction in his unemployment insurance. I had been doing this for some of the companies, and one day at the National Lead Company, I found out if they made an advance insurance premium of $1,000, that they would move into a new bracket and would save them $2,400 for the next year. I sent them the letter, and they immediately sent the check back and my authorization to go to Columbus and change the records. Soon after that was when they bought the Dohler Jarvis Company. And by getting the reduction that I had given them in the rate that saved them $2,400 for the National Lead Company, they saved $36,000 for the Dohler Jarvis Company.
Pat? Pat, you've just described the business activities during those 25 years. Did you have some outside activities other than business that might have been concurrent with that, the business?
Yes. When the children were old enough for me to take part in activities, I became interested in the YWCA and finally was made president of the Norwood branch of the YWCA. And soon after that, the children were in school and I became active in PTA work and was finally made president of the Sharpsburg school in South Norwood. I continued with my YWCA work and became a board member of the Greater Cincinnati YWCA, and at that time also was made chairman of the Girl Reserve Department for the Greater Cincinnati. This was the department that supervised the clubs of teenagers all over the city.
And what were some other volunteer work that you did or organizations that you were in?
Then after my husband's death, I became more active in peace organizations. When I was working with the YWCA, one of the secretaries said that she would like to recommend a book for me to read. I went to the library and got the book, Power of Nonviolence by Richard Gregg. After I had read and studied that book for 2 or 3 weeks, I decided that I would be a pacifist, that I felt that all wars were wrong and that we should remove the trouble that brought on the wars before we got into a war. And so from then on, that's the kind of work that I've been active in. I then joined the American Friends Service Committee and worked with them for several years. Then I heard about the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And though I didn't have any time to go to their meetings, I did start paying dues and continued to pay dues until, I think it was in 1958, some woman called me and said that they were going to run me as chairman of the Cincinnati branch of the Women's International League. And I said, oh, please, no. I said, I don't know anything much about the program. I know I've supported the organization, but I know very little about it. And so she said, well, I had been president of a PTA, and I knew how to handle meetings. And so in order to save the organization, I had to take it. And so I said, well, I would do what I could, and that I asked when they were going to have any kind of a meeting where I could get more information. She said they were getting ready to have a conference in Washington, D.C., and that I would get a lot of information. So I found out the dates and got ready and went to Washington, D.C. to attend the conference. This conference was one in which we were calling on our legislative senators and representatives and telling them how we felt about wars. So I continued working with that organization till I started then going to the Ohio meetings, which were usually held in Columbus or Delaware, or even Cleveland. And so I progressed very rapidly in that organization because I always said I was a good chauffeur and I would take everybody to the meetings. And so then when they needed a vice president, I was made vice president. And the president that year had to resign because she said she just couldn't carry on. So that meant I was moved up into the position of president. And being president of the Ohio State branch at that time qualified me to be a member of the National Board, which met in Philadelphia about 3 times a year. So at the end of that year, I was elected for 2 years, and then I was elected for another 2 years. So that meant that I served on the National Board for 5 years. And during the time I was on the national board, I was an associate delegate to the 50th anniversary conference, which met in Holland in 1965. When we went back to celebrate the beginning of the Women's International League, the 50-year beginning of the Women's International League, which had been organized in Holland in 1915.
Were there some outstanding issues that the organization dealt with, or certain events that stand out in your mind that you'd like to recall for us?
It was during this time that we became involved in the Vietnam War. We had met and pleaded and tried to get conditions changed so that we wouldn't get involved in the war, but we didn't succeed. And after we became involved in the war, we began to try to show how wrong it was and to get out of it. And so we made many trips to New York and to Washington, D.C., and other groups went to other cities, and we also demonstrated in Cincinnati, trying to get people to understand how wrong the war was and that we should not be involved. I recall one of the most interesting trips that I made to Washington was that I think there were 5 busloads that went from Cincinnati or from this part of the state. And we met with hundreds of buses from all over the United States at midnight in Arlington Cemetery. And we were going to have what was known as the Candlelight March. Every person was given the name of a war dead on a placard and put around their neck. And we had a candle, a lighted candle in a cup, which made, if you've ever seen at night, candles in
the procession. Do you mean the procession?
In paper cups, which makes a beautiful reflection, and there are thousands of people in a march like that. We had 3 caskets at the beginning of the march that were carried to the steps of the Capitol, and then those of us in the march with the placards, as we approached the caskets, each one laid the name of a war dead in the coffin and turned out, blew out our lights. This was a very emotional experience for us to go to, and one of the things that I remember that I was proud to have done when I was demonstrating against the war. One of the demonstrations that I especially remember happened in Cincinnati. We had a black draped casket in front of the federal building at 5th and Main, and we assembled to read the names of the war dead. It took 18 hours, the list was so long, and so we read those names for 18 hours. As 2 or 3 people stood with bowed heads at the black draped casket.
Are there other events that might have some historical significance that you were involved in with WILPF?
Well, I might tell you about my trip to the Pentagon.
Do, yes, do tell us.
You know, anyone that knows me knows that I feel like that I've got to let my legislators know and my president know how I feel about what they're doing. And so in one of the letters that I wrote to President Nixon, I was begging him to end the war and giving him my idea of how it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And And as the president so often, when he got a letter from me, turned it over to the State Department to answer. And they would send me a letter back and explain the president was doing everything right, and then they'd send me brochures from the State Department explaining why the government was involved in the war and why it was right for it to be there, and etc. This time, President Nixon turned my letter over to the Department of Defense, and I received a letter from a Deputy Associate Secretary from that department, and he was sending me a letter and a lot of material. And so this time I thought I had enough time. Usually I just filed the letters away and forgot about it and went on to some other subject and to another letter that I wanted to write. But this time I decided this man was so wrong in what he was saying to me that I just had to talk back to him. One of the things that he sent me was a November speech that President Nixon had made, which disturbed me very much at the time he made it, but I didn't send and get a copy of it. There was so much going on, you just couldn't do what you thought you ought to do. So, since he included the speech, I read it over and I decided that I would scratch it all up and put my opinions by different paragraphs that I thought he'd made mistakes and statements that he made. By the time I worked on the paper, it looked pretty scratched up. So I decided, well, I'll have to condense this, and I'll just put it in the form of a letter. I worked for about 3 days editing that letter, trying to reduce it to one page, which is about what you should have when you write to the president. Or to the Defense Department. At the end of the letter, I said, because I was feeling kind of slap happy and ornery, I guess, I'll be in Washington the 13th and 14th of April. This was at the end of March I was writing the letter, and I really was going to a legislative seminar in Washington at that time. And so I said, if you care to further discuss this with me, I'll be at a certain hotel, and told him the name of the hotel. I mailed a letter on Tuesday, and on Thursday, just when I was starting to the grocery store, the phone rang. At first I decided I wouldn't answer it, but I was so curious to know who was on the other end of the line that I stopped to answer the phone, and they said, Washington's calling. And I thought, well, I wonder who's calling me from Washington. And then they came back and said, Mr. Doolin is waiting to talk with you. And I thought, who in the world is a Mr. Doolin? Then all of a sudden it dawned upon me, oh, golly, that's the guy I wrote to in the Defense Department. And so he came on the line and he said, Mrs. Martin, I've just received your letter. I'd mailed it on Tuesday and this was Thursday, so he got me on the phone right away. And he said, do you still plan to come to Washington on the 13th and the 14th? And I said, yes, I'm still coming. And so he said, I'll be glad to see you at your convenience. And so I thought, oh dear, what kind of trouble have I gotten myself into? And I thought, I got to think right quick. And just before I started the grocery store, I had been looking over the program for Washington seminar, and I knew exactly what was in the program. But I said to him, just a minute till I check my schedule. I think I have a pretty heavy schedule when I come to Washington. And so I sat there and thought, what shall I do? And I thought, oh, the heck, I'll go ahead and see what he's got to say. So I said, well, I see that I can see you at the noon hour on Monday because I won't be busy having lunch. And he said, oh, you're going to be in the Peace Fast. And I said, yes, I am. I wondered what in the world, how he knew about the Peace Fast for the Women's International League. But anyway, he said, okay, I'll see you on Monday from 12 to 1. And I said, thank you. And where will I see you? And he said, take a taxi and come to the river entrance. Then it dawned upon me he was having me come to the Pentagon. And so I said, and he said, go into the reception desk and ask for me, and I'll come down and take you to my office. So I said, thank you very much. I talked to my daughter about it, and I said, I'm going to get in touch with our lobbyist in Washington so she can go with me. And my daughter said, no, Mother. She said, if you take somebody else, they'll do all the talking. Now, you got the appointment, and you're going to go and do the talking. So I thought, well, I guess I'll try. When I got to Washington, the only thing I said to my friends that morning was, I have to leave the meeting a little bit early, but I'll be back later on. So I just got up and went outside and picked up a taxi and went away and didn't tell anybody where I was going. Mr. Doolin sent his secretary down to take me up, and we went through her office and into his office. And when I went in, three men, all of them over 6 feet tall, stood up to greet me. I didn't know whether they thought I was Annie Oakley with a gun on my hip or why it was so important for three of them to be there. But they introduced themselves, and one of the men was another assistant secretary of defense. The other man was from the public relations department. Later on, I asked him why he came to the conference. And he said, well, it's the rule that there must always be a man from the public relations department when any visitor comes to the Pentagon. So I accepted that. Soon after the introductions were over, they said, Mrs. Martin, would you like a cup of tea? And I said, yes, thank you, because I'm not abstaining from liquids. So he had the secretary bring in tea and china cups, and so they drank tea with me. And the conference got started, and they questioned me for an hour. And so then I thanked them for their time. I don't think I'd convinced them of anything. They hadn't changed my opinion. I recall one question. They said, don't you think that President Nixon is doing everything he can to end this war? And I said, no, I do not. And so then I proceeded to go ahead and elaborate a little bit more on some of the opinions that I had that would end the war. Well, before I had arrived, a reporter from the Cincinnati Post had called and said that he understood that I had an appointment with the Pentagon, and my group back home had tipped the paper off, and that he would like to interview me, and they said they didn't know where I could be located, but when I came, they would tell me that the Post wanted to interview me, and they would let them know where they could find me. And so Mr. Doolin told me that the Post wanted to interview me, and that where could they find me, and he would let them know. So they were very nice, and when I got ready to leave, Mr. Doolin said, I'll call a taxi, and he told me which company he was calling, because he said there'll be dozens of taxis coming up to the door, and this is, be sure to remember the name of the taxi that you'll be getting. And when I got back to my group, I said to them, guess where I've been? And they said, you have no idea where you've been. And I said, I have been to the Pentagon. And they said, well, we know you're kidding us now, because you couldn't get to the Pentagon. And I said, no, I did get to the Pentagon. And they said, well, we've tried to get to the Pentagon. Nobody will see us in the Pentagon. And I said, well, I wrote a letter to the president, and he got somebody to see me in the Pentagon. I've really been there. And I said, and here's another thing. It's not everybody that goes to the Pentagon that can get the Assistant Secretary of Defense to make an appointment with a newspaper for them. And so I said, Mr. Doolin is going to call the Post and tell them where they can see me. So it was fun.
I didn't get the war ended then, but we never stopped. So, you know, we finally did get the war ended.
Since the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is an international organization, have you ever been out of the United States to other countries and involved in the international work?
Yes. When I was on the national board, I went to Europe as an alternate delegate to the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It had been organized in Holland, and we went back to the same town in Holland to have our 50th anniversary.
Pat, what was the outcome or the decisions made at the conference in Holland?
Well, at that time we developed the idea that it would be helpful, since we were, the United States was only the only belligerent nation, that if the women in the other 20 sections of the world in which we have branches would petition the women of the United States and give their support to our idea of asking our government to end the war in Vietnam. This was carried out, and thousands of petitions were sent to us from all over the world pleading with us to lend our influence for ending the war.
Did you attend any other international functions in WILPF?
Yes, in 1970, there was the American Women's Congress met in Bogota, Colombia, and I attended that Congress. There were other women's organizations from South America present, and the main thing that it seemed to me that came out of that conference was that the women of South America were there to stop any proliferation of the nuclear power coming into South America. They wanted no part of bombs or power stations or what have you, because of the great dangers that go along with using nuclear power.
And if you came up to today and were thinking about the current issues and situations that WILPF is dealing with, that you have been involved in, what would you care to say about that, the present day activities?
Well, I might tell you that there are a number of organizations to which I have belonged, such as SANE, Clergy and Laymen Concerned, the World Federalist, American Friends Service Committee, Fellowship of Reconciliation, Common Cause. Each of these organizations has been concerned that man can destroy himself. And in a different way, each has been working towards educating people to understand that we are heading towards destruction unless we have some different priorities than we have now. In the last year or so, there's been a great thought, however, for these organizations to combine and have more power than they have as separate organizations. We have many organizations belonging to the Mobilization for Survival. Women's International League is one of the active members in that. We have another organization that is getting collaboration with the other organization called New Directions. That probably is the organization that has the greatest number of members connected with it. Each one realizes the great danger and that the problems must be removed before we get into a nuclear holocaust. So for this reason, there's a greater activity because there's a greater danger day after day as a proliferation of the nuclear power is expanded and as the arms race progresses. And so for this reason, we're concerned. And we hope that the things that we do in Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the other organizations will arouse the citizens of the world to realize that war is not the way, that there is no security in an escalating arms race. Peace is the only security, and we should begin to insist upon it.
Well, thank you very much, Pat. You shared with us many of your life stories and activities over a number of years, and I'm sure it will be of importance to anyone who listens to these tapes. Thank you.